All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Nebraska is now open for the transaction of business. Draw nigh, all ye having business with this honorable court, and ye shall be heard. God save the State of Nebraska and this honorable court.
Thank you very much, and good morning to everyone. If you have risen, you may take a seat. This is the Chief Justice, so I will take a roll to make sure everybody is on board. Mr. Dahlquist, are you here?
Yes, Your Honor, I'm here.
Thank you very much. Mr. Smith?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you. And now, members of the court, Justice Miller-Lerman?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you. Justice Castle?
I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you. Justice Stacy?
Present.
Thank you. Justice Funk?
I'm here as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Justice Papik?
I'm here.
Thanks much. And Justice Frydenberg is recused from this matter. Now, the rules of the game are that each of you have... Each of you have 10 minutes, so we're going to give each of you 5 minutes to present, and there will be no questioning, so you will have 5 uninterrupted minutes to present your case. At the end of 5 minutes, if you haven't stopped, I will cut you off, and then we will go to questioning from members of the court, and that will be... That will be done on a random basis. So do the lawyers have any questions about that?
No, Your Honor.
No, Your Honor. It sounds like there'd be no need to reserve any time for rebuttal the way that the court has it set up. Would that be correct?
Well, that is sort of correct. You may reserve time for rebuttal, but our experience has been that we go way over your time. So if you want to, you can go ahead and
I've been listening.
Okay. You can go ahead and make that request if you wish.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. With that in mind, then, Mr. Dahlquist, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court and counsel for the state, Mr. Smith, please note the appearance of Rodney Dahlquist on behalf of the appellant, Talina Moser, as personal representative. Your Honor, the case before you involves the tragic assault, strangulation, and murder of Terry Berry at the hands of his cellmate while he was an inmate at the Tecumseh State Correctional Institute. In placing Mr. Berry in the same cell with his eventual killer, the state was negligent first in failing to follow mandatory safety regulations that are required to be met when double bunking inmates in restricted housing. And second, during the course of double bunking these two individuals, the state was negligent in failing to heed the specific warnings from a caseworker that Mr. Berry was at risk for harm at the hands of his cellmate. Because of the state negligence, Mr. Berry was eventually murdered. And the issues before you today are whether the state, under the circumstances, is shielded from liability because of either the discretionary function exception on which the district court grounded its decision, or the intentional tort exception to the State Tort Claim Act, which the state has raised here on appeal. Neither of those exceptions should apply. Because this matter was appealed following a motion to dismiss the complaint, the allegations in the complaint are taken as true for purposes of both the motion before the district court and for purposes of the appeal. Now, the Nebraska Department of Correctional Services has an administrative regulation that details the process by which inmates that are in restricted housing, and they're in restricted housing because they either pose some significant risk to the general population or the general population might victimize them. So they're in restricted housing for a particular reason to begin with. And there are factors that are to be considered when two individuals are going to share the same cell. And the most important step in that administrative reg is to synthesize, as I see it, those factors and make a determination in writing that the individual that is going to be double bunked is reasonably safe from assault at the hands of the cellmate. And in this case, that was simply not done. Additionally, there was a staff member, she's a caseworker there at Tecumseh, that raised a concern for Mr. Berry's safety. She was familiar with his personality traits, his proclivities, as well as the individual that Mr. Berry was housed with. And because of those tendencies and proclivities and their personalities and the fact that they were just simply incompatible, she attempted to contact the duty lieutenant on that day and get this double bunking circumstance stopped. However, she was told essentially that there wasn't anything that can be done. So despite the fact that the administrative regs, safety, mandatory administrative regs were not complied with, and there was a specific warning, these two individuals were bunked together, and a mere 5 days later, Mr. Berry was assaulted, strangled, and murdered at the hands of his cellmate. Now, the district court dismissed this action, finding that placing Mr. Berry with his killer in a single cell was discretionary. However, this finding was erroneous because neither of the two elements that are required to be met are found here. First, the conduct was not discretionary. In other words, there was no element of judgment or choice. The complaint goes into some significant detail about the underlying overcrowding conditions at Tecumseh that we contend forced the double bunking circumstance in the first place. But more forcefully, the fact is there's a mandatory safety regulation that was not complied with. And when there's a regulation in place, there is no discretionary immunity allowed if that regulation is not satisfied. The first prong is not met under discretionary function. Likewise, even if this court finds some modicum of discretion, it's not that high level executive or administrative type of discretionary decision that is intended to be shielded. This is not a lawsuit that is challenging the practice of double bunking. It's a challenge to the manner in which that policy decision was implemented. And because operational level discretion is not shielded under the statute, very simply, discretionary function does not apply. Now, the state has raised the application of the exception under the intentional tort, and that's subsection 4 of 81-82-19. And I think I misstated in my brief significantly under 81-2-219, that's a typo. Now, that purports to accept out from state liability any claim arising out of assault, battery, false imprisonment, so on and so forth. This is not, however, a perfunctory analysis in which any case that raises an assault or a battery automatically qualifies under that exception. It's a very nuanced argument that the state fails to draw the distinction that this court's prior decisions have drawn. And if you juxtapose a case such as Doe versus OPS and Johnson versus State, you will see that difference. And really, if you drill down to what the distinction is, it's the duty that is owed. And in this case, the estate's claim is not predicated solely upon some type of employment decision, whether that be negligent hiring, retention, supervision. It is predicated on the state's non-delegable breach of an independent legal duty, which is to maintain a reasonably safe housing circumstance for all of the inmates that are in Nebraska Department of Correction. This is a duty that's imposed under the... Yes, sir.
Your 5 minutes is up, so we're going to go to questioning.
Oh, yes, sir.
Now, and we're going to start with Justice Funk.
Thank you, Chief. Mr. Dahlquist, I guess my question is there any discretion in determining the appropriateness of placing Mr. Mosier with Mr. Schroeder? You articulate failing to follow safety regulations and a checklist, but is there discretion in making that determination of the appropriateness of placing these two individuals together?
I think there is discretion in a strictly dictionary sense, Your Honor. Yes. So in other words, operational level employees at Tecumseh can make a decision whether inmate A is housed with inmate B or inmate A is housed with inmate C. However, the level at which that decision is made is not the type of policy or high level decision that is intended to be shielded by the discretionary function exception. When it's a low level, or not low level, but an operational level, kind of rubber meets the road type decision, there will always be discretion. And everything we do, and almost every decision in life, there is some measure of discretion. However, it's that high level policy setting, whether or not the state is going to undertake a policy to do actions A, B, or C or not, those types of discretionary decisions are shielded under the exception.
You suggest that the safety regulation was not met. I'm assuming that means that there wasn't a evaluation of the characteristics of these two individuals and the compatibility of putting them together. Is that the argument on the safety regulation failing to be met?
That's correct, Your Honor. And it's, I have to, you know, candidly, it's difficult to say at this point exactly to what degree that was not met. It was dismissed prior to the conduct of discovery, but certainly from the point of view that we're at now, the most important step is that final one in which all of the factors, even if all the factors were looked at and compared or collected, the most important step, and really the only one that, I don't know if necessarily matters is the right word, but certainly the one that would provide the most insight as to whether or not we're ensuring that inmates are safe from harm, is that final step when all the factors are synthesized together and there is a conclusion made. And without that conclusion, you can go and collect all the factors that you would like, but you're kind of undermining the whole purpose of the regulation to begin with.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Dahlquist. Chief, I have no additional questions.
Thank you. Justice Babbitt.
Mr. Dahlquist, I'd like to ask you about the intentional torts exception. Do I understand you correctly to contend that the intentional torts exemption applies only when the act, whether it be assault or battery or any of the other intentional torts mentioned, are committed by an employee of the state?
Your Honor, I believe that at least as far as what I have been able to determine from this court's prior cases in the current circumstances, it certainly would seem that that is where the line has been drawn. I don't necessarily, certainly if it's a state employee, I think categorically, if you look at the underlying intent of that exception, why it's there in the first place, then certainly it seems like when the assault or battery or whatever the intentional tort is perpetrated by a state employee, then certainly it does apply. Could there be a hypothetical out there whereby you have a state employee commit an act and there's some an intentional tort and there is some breach of one of these non-delegable duties? I suppose that hypothetically that could be the case, but I think that's a great starting point at the very least. And certainly when you have a non-state employee, then this exception does not seem to apply as forcefully. And particularly when you have the enhanced here, you know, such as an OPS with a student at a school or an individual whose safety is solely within the hands of the state, that exception should not apply when it's under the current circumstances such as this.
What language would you point to in 81-82194 that limits the intentional tort exemption in the manner you suggest?
Subsection 4, I think what we could do, and not to, you know, broaden the question any further, Your Honor, but I certainly think that you could look at subsection 4 with subsection 1 and say that they're in pari materia when we are looking at the and plus you also could look at the balance of the rest of those subsections in 81-82-19 and say that these are effectively all actions that are undertaken by the state. So while I couldn't sit here and say specifically that subsection 4 has something that says when only committed by state employees. Obviously, that language is not specifically in there. We could look at the balance of that entire statute and say that it could be read in pari materia. I guess as I'm just taking a quick look at it here, you know, certainly false arrest, at least from my limited criminal experience, which is virtually nothing, would seem to indicate that, you know, only a state actor could commit a false arrest, malicious prosecution. You know, only a state actor could commit the tort of malicious prosecution. So something along for something language, specific language in subsection 4, Judge, I would point you to that, and I would ask the court to look at this kind of as a more in pari materia circumstance.
What have we said about how exemptions to the State Tort Claims Act and the Political Subdivisions Tort Claims Act, how those should be construed?
The language that this court has used in the past is that they should be construed narrowly and construed in favor of the state.
And does that leave room for us to engage in the kind of in pari materia reading you're asking us to undertake?
I believe it does, and it does so because the circumstances in which this exception has been found not to apply, and I'm specifically looking at the OPS case here, is one in which there, and I understand that is the Political Subdivision Act, but the circumstance in which it was found not to apply is one in which effectively the individual victimized here is one in which, you know, we're talking about a safety circumstance, and one in which the individual victim virtually has no control over his or her safety. It's one in which, you know, parents drop the kids off in the morning, and safety is the exclusive providence of the school. Very much like an inmate at state corrections, safety of an inmate, by and large, is virtually the sole exclusive province of the Department of Corrections. So, looking at the types of circumstances that we are talking about where there is an explicit separate duty, I do believe there's enough discretion within the court's authority to look at this more in pari materia and find a very limited, narrow exception for cases such as this.
Thank you. I have no additional questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Justice Miller Lerman.
Yes, thank you. Focusing yet again on sub 4, which items in your complaint do you contend remove the application of sub 4 from this case, make it inappropriate to go into that subsection for analysis? And as I understand it, sub 4 is raised for the first time on appeal, but that's not the issue under our Davis case, but rather focusing on your complaint, and this was a motion to dismiss. How do you evade evaluation under sub 4?
The allegations in the complaint, Your Honor, very clearly relate to individuals who are within the custody of the state and state corrections. And because of that, there is a non-delegable duty under the Eighth Amendment and under the Nebraska Constitution, Article 1-9, to guard against cruel and unusual punishment. And part of that guarding against cruel and unusual punishment is to ensure that inmates are reasonably, of course, there's no guarantees, but reasonably safe from assault at the hands of other inmates. So that, I believe, is pretty clearly pled. The circumstances in which the two individuals, Mr. Berry and his assailant in this case, were, as well as the fact they were both in custody of the state, as well as the nature of the exception. I believe that is pled sufficiently so that the court could find that there is this kind of special relationship between Mr. Berry and the state here, so that it's not, we're not predicating the act solely on a respondeat superior or negligent hiring or retention circumstance. Rather, the complaint lays out that he was incarcerated, and because of that, his safety is really in the exclusive hands of the Department of Corrections.
So that would be a duty, the negligence would arise, that you allege would arise from that duty. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
Thank you. No further questions.
Thank you, Justice Castle.
Based on a fair reading of your complaint and giving it the reading that we're required to do under our de novo standard of review, is it a fair reading to say that the allegations of the complaint would demonstrate that the acts of the other inmate were a but-for cause of the damage?
That, I believe the question is getting to some type of superseding cause of the harm. And I don't believe that the doctrine of a superseding cause would be applicable in the current fact pattern, because it's only a superseding cause and cutting off the negligence of the underlying tortfeasor if at the time of the negligent conduct, the state shouldn't have realized that there was some harm being created. Well, here we have the fact that the administrative regulation was not complied with, and we have specific warnings from the caseworker at Tecumseh that Mr. Berry was at some risk for harm. There is indicia, at least, that the state should have known that Mr. Berry was at risk for harm because of the circumstance in which he was being placed. And therefore, under the superseding clause, it would not apply in that circumstance.
I guess maybe I was looking at it at a more simplistic level and not the superseding cause issue, but simply without the battery committed by the other inmate, the event would not have resulted in any harm to the decedent, correct?
That would be correct, and that would get to kind of the final element of the four, standard elements of negligence. You would have your duty, breach, causation, damage. And so the duty and breach were established at the time of the placement would be the argument. And then the damage would be, in this case, unfortunately, the murder and whatever the resulting damages were from that.
Okay. Thank you. I have no other questions.
Thank you very much. Justice Stacy.
Thank you. Counsel, reading your complaint and giving it every reasonable inference in favor of the plaintiff, is the claim itself something bigger than just the decision to house Berry and Schroeder together? Is there anything more to it than that?
And I apologize, I just want to make sure I understand the question. As far as any type of cause of action or theory of recovery,
correct,
because of conditions at Tecumseh, is that essentially what you're
Let me put my question in context. I did a poor job. The trial court's order had one sentence that said the decision to house Berry and Schroeder together was discretionary. It then concluded that the entire claim falls within the discretionary function exception to the State Tort Claims Act. My question to you is, did the trial court fairly characterize your claim in saying that it was based solely on the decision to house Berry and Schroeder together, or is your claim something more than that?
Thank you, Judge. The claim is absolutely more than that. And not only did the state fail to comply with the initial requirements when you're going to house two inmates together who are in restricted housing, failing to comply with those safety requirements, but also, and that's kind of where I see the decision to house these two together was negligent, but also They were housed together on April 10th of 2017, and nobody, despite the fact that there were warnings attempted to be raised, nobody checked on whether or not Mr. Berry was reasonably safe, and we can tell that because nobody even ensured that the paperwork was done correctly, that the final written synthesis of all the factors was done. Nobody went and checked on Mr. Berry for the ensuing 5 days, during which time he could have been moved out of the circumstances. So it's not just the fact that he was originally placed there, which we contend was negligently and inappropriately, but it's also the fact that the state failed to heed specific warnings from its own employees about the fact that Mr. Berry was at risk for harm. So the sentence, kind of the very brief order that we were given and the one sentence summary, does not fairly characterize all of the allegations. And that part of it, that second part where the state did not heed its own specific warning from its own employee, is probably the most egregious part of this whole circumstance.
Is it your position that if permitted to conduct discovery, the plaintiff might be able to uncover allegations of negligence in addition to the ones that have been alleged currently?
I believe that to be the case, yes, Your Honor. And we're just really going off of some limited information at this point, obviously, whatever has been disclosed publicly. And so what we will find through the course of discovery absolutely could highlight additional acts of negligence.
So there are certainly some cases where a court can determine as a matter of law whether an exception under the State Tort Claims Act applies. Give me your best argument for why this isn't that kind of a claim.
Well, this would not be that kind of a claim because the full factual record has not been developed, and we're stuck with obviously just the allegations that were raised in the complaint. And given an opportunity through the course of discovery, there could be additional acts or omissions on the part of individuals who were either making the decision to house Mr. Berry in a double bunking circumstance, individuals who knew and either failed to follow up on the complaints of this caseworker. There could be a number of other facts that we have not alleged in the complaint that we just simply don't know at this very early procedural stage of the case that might come to light. And a more fully developed record on summary judgment, for example, might be the appropriate time for the court, the district court, to take up the issue of whether the State Tort Claim Act or any of the exceptions would be applicable.
Thanks. I don't have any additional questions, Chief.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dahlquist. I want to take you back to the intentional tort exception and the Doe case that you made reference to on a number of occasions. Was there some precedent that this court used in the Doe case to get where it got in that case?
I'm trying to recall the facts, I can have a very high level sense of the facts of the Doe case, but as far as any particular precedent, I can't speak specifically to the Doe case, but I certainly know that the State Tort Claim Act is patterned off of the federal act, and many of the decisions of the federal courts are utilized as influential on how this court views those exceptions and the limits and the contours of those exceptions.
Thank you very much. I think that is all the questions that I have for you. Does anybody have follow-up questions they want to ask Mr. Dahlquist?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm not hearing any follow-up questions, Mr. Dahlquist. So we will go on to Mr. Smith. Good morning to you. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm James D. Smith with the Nebraska Attorney General's Office, here on behalf of the appellee, the state of Nebraska. The legal foundation of this case are five basic principles of statutory construction in state tort claims act cases involving issues of sovereign immunity and waiver of sovereign immunity. The five principles have all been recently stated by this court. Because of their importance, I'm going to state them now. They are, number one, well, it is well settled that statutes that purport to waive the protection of sovereign immunity of the state are strictly construed in favor of the sovereign and against the waiver. Principle two, a waiver of sovereign immunity is found only where stated by the most express language of the statute or by such overwhelming implication from the text as will allow no other reasonable construction. Third principle is that statutory language is to be given its plain and ordinary meaning, and an appellate court will not resort to interpretation to ascertain the meaning of statutory words which are plain, direct, and unambiguous. The fourth principle is that an appellate court must determine whether sovereign immunity lies from the underlying substance of a dispute as the, quote, gravamen of the complaint test, end of quote. Under this test, parties cannot defeat the legislature's intent to preserve exceptions to the state's sovereign immunity by attempting to plead around statutory exceptions through a semantic recasting of events. And the fifth and final basic principle is because the rationale for the intentional torts exception has not always been clearly expressed, the rule of strict construction becomes critically important. The state's position that there are two exceptions that apply to the State Tort Claims Act waiver of sovereign immunity in this case, and either one supports the district court's dismissal. The first exception is the discretionary function exception. The second exception is the assault and battery exception. The assault and battery exception in the language of the statute accepts out any claim arising out of assault or battery. The discretionary function language of the statute exempts out any claim based upon the exercise or performance or the failure to exercise or perform a discretionary function or duty on the part of a state agency or an employee of the state, whether or not the discretion is abused. Going to the assault and battery exception, which bars the estate suit, the estate's claim arises out of the assault and battery of Berry by inmate Patrick Schroeder. But for the battery, the estate would have no claim. Other factors that are alleged, including factors of negligence, are alleged to be factors causing Berry's death. But any way you look at it, the gravamen of the estate's complaint is an assault and battery by an inmate resulting in the death of Berry. The estate has attempted to plead around the gravamen of the case by attempting to phrase its complaint as negligence by state officials or negligence in not protecting Berry, but it all disregards the underlying arising out of battery exception to the State Tort Claims Act. The estate cannot do so upon applying the principles of statutory construction in the State Tort Claims Act sovereign immunity case. The discretionary function exception also bars the estate's lawsuit. This is because the nature of the estate's conduct was where to house inmates and with whom. The conduct in housing inmates and with whom was a matter of judgment. Because the challenged conduct involves the element of judgment, the discretionary function exception applies. And as this court has said, it is the nature of the conduct rather than the status of the actor that governs whether the discretionary function exception applies in a given case. With that, I'm ready for questions.
Thank you very much, Justice Funk.
Thank you, Chief. Mr. Smith, how does our holding in Doe play into the decision in this case on the issue of any special relationship?
Well, Doe did depend upon creating a spatial relationship. Excuse me, I had a timer go off. Doe did depend upon the court creating a what I would call almost judicially legislating a spatial relationship and crafting it onto the state court claims acts exceptions. That spatial relationship exception is not found in the text of the waiver of sovereign immunity. The plain and ordinary language, it is not there. And if the court applies as it should, the five basic principles of statutory construction that I articulated, the Doe case has no foundation.
Do we have to overrule Doe to follow your argument of the intentional tort exemption?
I think you would have to either overrule or distinguish it. I'm not sure how you could distinguish it.
That was my next question. How would you distinguish it?
I guess when I start saying I would distinguish it by saying it's wrong, that sounds like overruling.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Smith. Chief, I have no additional questions.
Thank you. Justice Papik.
Mr. Smith, I'm going to allude to a question that the Chief Justice asked opposing counsel, about what precedent, if any, the Doe court relied upon, and if you have a position about whether that precedent should have any bearing for us as we consider whether it was correctly decided.
I do. I would acknowledge that when one gets into it, one will find precedent by what I would call essentially a split concurring decision of the U.S. Supreme Court under the Federal Tort Claims Act and subsequent federal cases that appear to rely upon or create that special relationship exception. I don't think those cases should allow to be continued if the court follows its statutory construction principles. As far as just articulating stare decisis, I would point out that stare decisis per U.S. Supreme Court opinion provides no veneer of respectability to continued application of demonstratively incorrect precedents. That comes from Gamble v. United States, 139 Supreme Court, 1960. And that same court or opinion says to ensure that we are not perpetuating and usurpation of legislative powers, the court should reevaluate our continued recognition of basically incorrect precedent. If one goes to the issue of legislative acquiescence, I would say legislative acquiescence should not be a foundation for this court's opinion. In that regard, I would cite the U.S. Supreme Court opinion of Bob Jones v. United States, 461 U.S. 574, which notes that courts are slow to attribute significance to the failure of a legislature to act on particular legislation. Same court opinion on action by legislature is not a useful guide, and a legislature affirmatively manifests its acquiescence by subsequent legislation that the legislature has not subsequently put in special relationship language to the exceptions under the Tort Claims Act. That same Bob Jones case, I'm sorry, there's case Kimbrough v. United States, 552 U.S. 85, says ordinarily we resist reading legislative intent into legislative inaction. I could point out a recent case that's still pending before this court, in which was the Candyland case involving the need to somehow serve 512 private people by a statute providing for service at the Attorney General's office. The problem with that statute was clearly noted by this court in Cargill Meat v. Colfax County, 281 Nebraska 93. The court said, stating the obvious, the legislature needs to correct this procedural trap. 9 years later, the legislature apparently acquiesced in not fixing the statute. And I don't think they acquiesced. They simply didn't take any action. Long answer, but next question I'd be ready for.
Thank you. I do not have additional questions, Chief.
Thank you. Justice Miller-Lerman.
Oh, thank you. The basis on which the trial court decided this included sub one, the discretionary exception, correct?
That's correct.
So if we were to agree with that analysis, would it be necessary to take up four? In other words, could we avoid the temptation of taking up four in this case?
Yes, because either of the two exceptions, discretionary function and assault and battery exception, either one of those would be sufficient to affirm dismissal by the district court, and thus if the court found that the district court correctly dismissed for the discretionary function exception, there would be no need to address the assault and battery.
Right. So, but nevertheless, since you have sub four in front of us, I guess we're down on semantics, but I refer to it as intentional tort exception, not the assault and battery exception. If we refer to sub four, if the jailers had put a new cellmate in with Mr. Barry, who was positive for Corona-19 virus, and the gentleman died, would the state be immune under sub four?
Well, I guess that comes down to whether that would be viewed as an assault and battery, which I'm not sure that would be viewed as an assault or battery, and as opposed to this case, an inmate who murders another inmate clearly has committed assault and battery, so I'm having some difficulty, unless the court's question wants me to assume that what a guard does in putting a person with coronavirus in with another inmate does constitute an assault and battery.
Or a foreseeable act of harm.
Well, actually, I would go back to the language of the statute. Simply says, it doesn't say foreseeable harm, it says any claim arising out of assault and battery.
So then you would say that four would not have any application?
It wouldn't have any application if it's not a claim arising out of assault and battery.
Thank you.
Justice Castle.
Mr. Smith, Doe was a political subdivision Tort Claims Act case. This arises under the State Tort Claims Act. Are you essentially conceding that for purposes of our analysis in this case, there is no significant difference based on that distinction?
I hesitate to concede that far without having the Political Subdivision Act before me and having reviewed it. My recollection is that the language is the same, but I'm not positive.
Let's, of course, in response to one of our decisions, the State Tort Claims Act was amended, so I don't think they are any longer the same, but I think they probably were. For purposes of my question, assume they were the same at the time of the Doe decision. How would that inform us, if at all? Do you think there's a meaningful distinction?
As I indicated to Judge Funk, I don't see there would be a meaningful distinction, or at least one that I can come up with.
Thank you. I have no other questions.
Thank you, Justice Stacy.
Thank you. Mr. Smith, section 81-8209 is the section in which the legislature tells us the purpose of the State Tort Claims Act, and it says that the state of Nebraska shall not be liable for the torts of its officers, agents, or employees, except to the extent and only to the extent provided by the act. So with that in mind, how would it affect our State Tort Claims Act jurisprudence if we were to hold that the assault and battery exception applies only to batteries by state officers, agents, or employees?
I don't think it fits or squares with the specific statutory language of sub 4 of the exceptions. And then the basic principle, there must be express language of a statute or such overwhelming implication from the text as will allow no other reasonable construction. I think a construction saying it applies only to state employees would be not following the basic principles of statutory construction.
Is it your contention that the State Tort Claims Act ever would apply to the conduct of someone other than a state officer, agent, or employee?
Well, if one is suing the state, as was done in this case, one is necessarily suing the state for its actions, but we still have the actions in which if the claim arises out of an assault and battery, as this does, that exception would mean that the state's sovereign immunity applies.
I don't have any additional questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. I have one question for you in regard to the discretionary function exception. At some point, there is a line between what is ministerial and what is discretionary. Where should that line be? And ultimately, I guess, the decisions in this case, I've got a double negative here, but I'll ask it this way. Why were they actually discretionary?
I think they're discretionary because the conduct of this challenged involves the element of judgment in the conduct in housing inmates together and with whom. And this court has said that's the nature of the conduct, not the status of the actor, that governs whether a discretionary function applies. I would point out to the court, paragraph 75 of the complaint is of interest in conjunction with paragraph 73 of the complaint. Paragraph 73 of the complaint says two unit managers, basically the prison, were responsible for making the joint decision to double bunk Barry and Schroeder. Paragraph 75 says the unit manager did not complete the compatibility assessment until after each inmate was warned that they would be double bunked with another inmate if they did not comply with the directive to move cells. So the complaint on its face, when it talks about unit managers exercising their judgment, needed to do some compatibility assessment, the complaint on its face simply involves the timing of when the compatibility assessment was done and that it was done after they were warned, which to me smacks of judgment.
Thank you very much. I do not have any further questions. Does anyone else on the court have a follow-up question they want to ask Mr. Smith?
No, thank you.
No.
Very good. With that in mind, I don't believe there's any time for rebuttal for Mr. Dahlquist. So I want to thank both Mr. Dahlquist and Mr. Smith for participating telephonically with this particular oral argument. And with that in mind, the court is adjourned and you are excused.
Thank you.
Your Honor, now that we've returned, I do want to express appreciation for both counsel that the court allowed us to make arguments, did so telephonically, and the process followed seemed to work surprisingly well. Thank you.
I agree. 100% agree. Thank you very much, all.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.